This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Vanity Fair magazine as we know it today has not always been Vanity Fair magazine as we know it today. Something of a cultural touchstone, if granted that stone is in New York, Washington, or Los Angeles, and the people in its pages are rich and famous. 35 years ago, Vanity Fair was a floundering reboot of a magazine from the 1920s and 30s, trying to find its voice, advertisers, and profitability in roughly that order. They found all three in London, England, in the person of Tina Brown. Her telling of those times went into her diary, which had now been published as a book called The Vanity Fair Diaries. Tina Brown, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
There is a lot in this book to hash over, which we will do in due course. But I want to talk about an idea that ran through this book, for me anyway, at least as I read it. And it was the idea of America. You like this country, and you liked it long before you came.
I did. I always had this big daydream when I was living in London, working as a young editor at Tatler. I took over at 25. But to me, America was always the big time. You know, I always thought, this is where the action is. And I wanted to be here badly because, you know, I'm a girl of the arena. I wanted to be out there with the action.
You brought up your age, so I don't feel bad jumping off that question. You were like 30 years old when you took over this magazine. You were a child.
You know, now it just seems very young. At the time, I felt more than ready, yeah, having spent that time in London editing Tatler. But when I took over Vanity Fair, it was so enthralling, such an extraordinary time, because not only was I just turned 30, but, you know, I really didn't know many people in America. And, you know, it was the time of the Reagan 80s when it was all Miami Vice and Madonna and you know, Dynasty. And at the same time, that crazy black tie world of the Reagan White House that, you know, at a certain echelon of society, which was Vanity Fair's meat, was, you know, throbbing away at the same time.
Well, you know, it's funny. You fess up early in the book that this was, well, here's what you say. The years spent among the moneyed elite of Manhattan, L.A., and the Hamptons in the overheated bubble of Condé Nast, the most glamour-focused magazine publishing company on the planet. You were having a good time, huh?
Well, you know, I was always an observer at the feast. You know,
No. Come on. You were at the feast. There are more dinner parties and cocktail parties and drinks and you name it in this book than I can count.
I was totally at the feast. I was totally at the feast, but I always kept my beady eye going. Very often when I went out, amazing things happened. Like one night I went to a fundraiser to raise money for suicide survivors, and William Styron, the writer, got up and started talking about his depression. And I went over and I asked him to write a piece for Vanity Fair. And he did. He said he agreed. And he wrote this amazing piece that we call Darkness Visible about his chronic depression, which caused the most enormous reaction and hugely helpful to people who'd suffered. And he went on to write a best-selling book about it. So very often going out was the way I got material.
It takes till about, 300-ish pages into this thing until you talk about being a woman in New York publishing in the 1980s. Why'd you wait so long?
Well, I think that's really the theme. Well, actually, that's not so. I mean, there's a theme. The theme throughout really is of a young woman sort of learning how to be a boss. You know, a lot of what the book is about is learning how to run things, learning how to be a boss, learning how to, persuade people to do things. And I think another theme really is getting the management to kind of take me seriously for my strategies, because I did many things for Vanity Fair, like turning it around, making it a success, and, for instance, launching a British edition. All of these things were really business strategy, which never was quite understood as that. You know, the management tended to say, kind of the equivalent of don't worry your pretty head about the business side and just focus on the editorial side. But actually, and a good editor has to be a part of all of that. And I did do all of that at Vanity Fair and sometimes felt that, you know, one had to kind of fight to get heard.
A word here, actually, about women and something you said earlier, you know, this idea of being a woman in the working world in New York City in the 1980s and now what you're doing with your conferences. And then, of course, the moment we find ourselves now in,
yes,
in this country. You must have seen that coming.
Well, I did. And, you know, the thing is that what I really, my feeling is, it's not rocket science to make this whole thing go away with sexual harassment. The answer is more women in power. You know, I was a boss lady from the age of 25 and running things. Therefore, I wasn't subject to what classic sexual harassment, which is somebody wanting to extract from you sexual favors and you feel your career is in peril if you don't somehow oblige. That doesn't happen to you when you are the one in power, making the decisions. More women in power equals less sexual harassment. And, you know, the Weinstein Company had 10 men on the board, okay? No women. No women on that board. So it's all about having more women in power, whether it's the Supreme Court or whether it's, you know, the Senate or whether it's media. You need more women in power.
Tina Brown. It's called The Vanity Fair Diaries, 1983 to 1992. Tina, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.